It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Yes, yet another ransomware attack in Florida, and now Georgia as well, and what your city should be doing to protect your data. Also coming up, we'll take a look at cloud breaches. There's a couple of new ones, including one that you just won't believe. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson. Episode 721, recorded Tuesday, July 2nd, 2019. Exposed Cloud Databases. Security Now is brought to you by LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Just remember your master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more. And by CashFly. Give your users the seamless online experience they want. Power your site or app with CashFly's CDN, Content Delivery Network, and be 30% faster than the competition. Learn more at securitynow.cashfly.com. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-grade cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and up to 6 times faster with no hidden fees for egress or API requests. Start a free trial at wasabi.com. Don't forget to use the offer code SecurityNow. It's time for Security Now. We're going to save your bacon today. The king of bacon saving, Mr. Steve Gibson, is here. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again for episode 721.
Holy moly.
Counting down to 999 and the end of existence.
Can you stop saying that? You're making me sad. I know it's years away, but it just makes me sad.
Well, we're going to have resolved all of these problems.
Oh, that's right. Never mind. No problem.
So, there'll be like nothing left to talk about.
Yeah, it's all fixed now.
I have mentioned before that I deliberately skip over stories about yet another exposed database in the cloud. But three different things happened in this past week. And one of them is like a little bit breathtaking, so much so that we're going to redefine what the initials IoT stand for.
Oh, boy. But initialization first, of terror?
That's not bad. But first, we're going to track further occurrences, believe it or not, further occurrences of ransomware in Florida and elsewhere. We check in on the state of this going dark anti-encryption debate, and I stumble into something that's more than I could cover with everything else we have to do today. So it's probably our topic for next week, which is the Ghost Protocol. I kid you not. That's its official name, which GCHQ has proposed. We're also going to look at a new stunning Bluekeep proof of concept demo, which was produced by the guys at Sophos Labs. We update a bunch of miscellany, some closing the loop feedback from our terrific listeners, and then spend much more time than we normally do on this nature of the continuing problem of massive publicly exposed databases on the internet. As I mentioned, in this third example of the three that occurred just this week, we discover a prolific Chinese IoT manufacturer who is logging more than 1 million of their customers' devices' activities into a massive, more than 2 billion record publicly exposed database. They have not responded to calls to shut it down, to protect it from the public, which returns us to the dilemma that we were talking about, I think, very usefully last week, although it's a dilemma without a solution, so that's annoying, which is the utter lack of oversight and control that we have now over our own IoT devices and what it means, which brings us to the need to soberly rename what IoT is an abbreviation for. So I think an interesting podcast for our deserving listeners, and a very apropos picture of the week, as it happens.
We have a number of speculative guesses in the chat room for what IoT might now stand for. I think one of them is accurate, so I won't say a word.
If somebody cheated and looked at the end of the show notes.
Oh, yeah, that's in the show notes, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, our show today brought to you by a very important security component everybody ought to be using. Everybody knows passwords are broken. There's great people working like Steve Gibson on stuff to replace passwords. But until they win the battle, and that may be a long time off, we're going to need passwords for apps, for websites. It's just how you're authenticated. So if you're going to use passwords, you got to use a password manager. And if you're going to use a password manager, you got to use the best, LastPass. The number one most preferred password manager, 13.5 million people use LastPass, 13.5 million. And we use it too. I use it at home. I've used it since it came out practically. Started with LastPass Premium, then upgraded to LastPass Families because it made it so easy for me to share passwords. Just the other day, Lisa said, oh, could you put that subscription password in share it with me? I said, no problem, because I just drag it to the family folder where it's automatically shared. No trouble, no fuss, no muss. It also has a really good feature called emergency access. I can designate, and I have, my wife and my daughter so that they have emergency access if anything should happen to me. I mean, I think this is something we all have to think about. Everything's in that password vault. And by the way, I trust LastPass so much. It's encryption, it's security so much. I put more than just passwords in there. I put secure notes with all sorts of important things, social security numbers. My will is in LastPass, my driver's license, my passport, and my family's passports and driver's license. It's all in there. And it's important that people be able to access that if something should happen to me. So emergency access is a great feature. That's in LastPass Families. I got to mention, though, there is more than that. There is LastPass for Teams and LastPass Enterprise, and that's what we use at Twit. We learned very early on that employees will do all sorts of crazy things with passwords. Not only put them on post-it notes on the side of the screen because they can't remember it, they'll share it with other people. We had one employee make a public website with all his passwords freely accessible and readable. Just because he couldn't remember him. I don't blame him, but that's why we started using LastPass. LastPass is encrypted everywhere except on device. Even LastPass can't get access to your passwords, so it's super secure. They use PBKDF2 to make sure it's unbrute-forcible. How many iterations is it now, Steve? 100,000? They use a huge number of iterations. They're doing everything right. They've just introduced something new that we will be using. I'm very excited about. It's their new business lineup. Three new products that give IT additional control. This is in their enterprise product and the convenience users expect. So LastPass Enterprise now includes single sign-on technology. This is great because while being more secure, it also is easier for your employees to use. 1,200-plus pre-integrated apps. So you get the market-leading password management capabilities, but also you can use this SSO for apps that are compatible, and that's I have to say, I personally love it. It's so easy, but it's so secure. LastPass Enterprise manages access for every entry point in a single solution. So if you have an app that's SSO, they'll use the SSO. Otherwise, the password manager and autofill. It's one of the things LastPass has always done so well, even on iOS and Android. I love that. There's also LastPass MFA. This is more than 2FA. This is multi-factor authentication, not two-factor authentication, because it uses biometrics and other factors like geolocation to ensure only the right users access the right data at the right time, but it doesn't add complexity for the user. I love that feature. So perhaps you've seen things like this with Google, for instance, saying, you know, sending you a message saying somebody logged on from a location that's unusual. It's that kind of thing. And having that in LastPass, to me, just it shows they're state of the art. There's also LastPass Identity. Now, this is a combination of LastPass Enterprise and MFA. It gives you, the IT department, a holistic view of end-user activity from a single dashboard. It's covering passwords. It's covering authentication. It's covering all apps in use, from single sign-on and password management to adaptive authentication. LastPass Identity gives granular control to IT and frictionless access to users. It's kind of amazing because we've always said there's a trade-off between security and convenience. Well, there are some security tools that actually are more convenient, and LastPass has them all. We have used LastPass Enterprise at Twit religiously. I've used LastPass for more than a decade since they first started. Personally, I'm really excited about these products, and I invite you to check them out. So no matter what level you're operating, as an individual, as a family, as a team, or in an enterprise, you got to check out LastPass. Go to LastPass.com/Twit. LastPass is bridging the gap between access and authentication to simply and securely manage identity. And that's really the bottom line. It's all about identity. LastPass.com/Twit. Check it out. I think you're going to love it. Now to Steve. What are you laughing at?
Well, our picture of the week, which is, it's not genius, but it's just fun. We have the boss sitting behind his desk, and he has an employee standing in front of the desk who announces to his boss, "Our devices are now 100% secure." And the boss is very impressed. He says, "How did you do that?" All caps. And the employee says, "I turned them all off."
The only way, baby.
So, yeah. Speaking of turning them all off, more ransomware news from Florida. We talked last week.
So amazing.
I know.
It's so amazing.
We talked last week about
Riviera Beach was
Riviera Beach, yeah. Yes, in Florida, right? And that was a relatively small community of 30,000. On June 10th, the computers of Lake City, Florida, population 12,000, ceased to function as malware encrypted their data after they were hit by a powerful ransomware attack that was named Triple Threat because it mixes three different methods of compromise. As we have always seen, and this happened again, an employee opened a document they received in email, which infected the city's network with the Emotet Trojan, which later downloaded the TrickBot Trojan, and then later that downloaded the Ryuk, R-Y-U-K, ransomware. And Ryuk is something that we're going to be here, or maybe it's Ruck. Anyway, I like Ryuk.
I'm guessing it's like the Three Stooges. Yuck, yuck, yuck. It's Ruck, Ruck, Ruck.
Ruck, Ruck, Ruck.
Y-R-Y-R-U-K, right?
Ruck, 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 Ruck. Ruck, Ruck, Ruck. So the Ruck ransomware, but that's really nothing to Ruck, Ruck, Ruck about. It is, in this case, these guys quickly detected the attack, disconnected the affected systems within minutes of the discovery that something was very wrong. But that, of course, all this stuff moves at the speed of light. So the malware was still able to infect systems controlling most of the city's landline, phones, and email systems, and, of course, lots of other ancillary systems. The landline, phones, and email being communications was, very much in everyone's face, which forced employees to revert to pen and paper in an attempt to continue working. Fortunately, in this case, the police and fire and other emergency services remained unaffected since they were on a separate network. They didn't receive a demand for ransom immediately, and they were wondering whether it might have been because they quickly took the systems offline, thinking that maybe the bad guys didn't know they had been infected. But it turns out that wasn't the case. The request was received for ransom a week later by the Florida League of Cities, which is the insurance provider for the city of Lake City, which is the city that was infected. So to me, this represents...
You're saying that the ransomware guys bypassed the middleman and went straight to the insurance company?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I know, which is a little chilling.
Well, it's a spear phishing attack, right? These are targeted attacks.
Yes, yes. So this league, the Florida League of Cities, the insurance carrier, began negotiating with the attacker and agreed to pay 42 Bitcoin. At the time, Bitcoin has been jumping around a lot recently. It hit a peak at 13,000, but it just today dropped below 10. But at the time, it was 400,000. And I was interested to hear that the attacker sent the ransom demand to the city's insurance carrier. This suggests more sophistication than I had expected, but I think we need to recalibrate ourselves. Get this. The city's information technology director, whose name is Brian Hawkins, said, quote, "Our systems are shut down, but there is no evidence to indicate any sensitive data has been compromised," which would be, painting a happy face on this disaster.
There's no evidence.
Of course, again, he's the city's information technology director, Brian Hawkins.
He's the guy responsible for this then.
We'll be coming back to him in a moment. He said all customer service payment data, such as credit card data, is stored off-site by third-party vendors and would not have been accessed by an attack like this on our network. However, with no proper backup to restore the data, Lake City was left with no option but to pay the ransom. Thus, the city's leadership approved the ransom payment last Monday. 42 bitcoins were paid last Tuesday, and the city's IT staff began decrypting files later the same day. So, pretty quick action, negotiated with the insurance carrier. The insurance carrier... in fact, I'm getting ahead of myself because I have here written down the show notes. Mayor Stephen Witt said that the administration made the decision to pay up after talking with the FBI. And when the FBI probably said, there's nothing we can do to help you. And so Stephen Witt said, okay, thank you. Next.
The FBI's standard recommendation is do not pay. But, in this case, I think you have to change your tune if you have no recourse because – normally they say don't pay for two reasons. It incents the bad guys. Well, believe me, we don't need to incent them anymore. And,
right.
And it often doesn't work because they may not have or give you the key. But I've been thinking about this. Something so highly publicized,
yes,
you're going to get the key because the ransomware authors want you to think paying works.
Yes.
It may not if you're just a private individual. But if you're a city, I think you have a better shot at getting it back, don't you?
Well, and as we talked about last week, when we looked at two previous instances, the Riviera Beach and one in Atlanta, it wasn't Riviera because they were the people who paid $600,000. Right. So it was two
Baltimore
previous ones.
Baltimore didn't pay, and they were down for weeks and weeks.
And the remediation cost millions, many millions of dollars. So, although no one wants to pay, unfortunately, it actually ends up being the least expensive proposition. So in this case – For this city, their deductible was $10,000. So they paid $10,000. The insurance carrier paid the balance. And the city's IT director, Brian Hawkins, was fired.
Thank you.
So,
thank you, yes. You nitwit.
Yes, exactly. So we have 42 bitcoins this week. 65 the week before. So that's in the neighborhood of $1.3 million for these two cities. So this creates a dilemma.
There's a third Florida city, by the way, Biscayne Beach, I think.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm just getting to
it. Oh, good. All right.
So attackers, here's the problem. Attackers have apparently found an interesting niche to
It's a good
attack.
Niche. It's a good niche.
We like individuals, smaller government municipalities apparently lack sufficient IT infrastructure to allow them to both protect from and recover from targeted attacks. But unlike individuals, they have much more important data at stake, as well as insurance, to take the short-term sting out of paying up. And they've got arguably much deeper pockets as well. So, okay, here's a test. I want everyone currently listening to this podcast to raise your hands if you think that, well, unless you're driving, if you think
then raise that the a bad, finger.
That the, okay, a finger, good. Yes, take a finger off the wheel. If you think that the bad guys have all the money they want and will now stop pestering deep-pocketed, well-insured, small municipalities with targeted attacks.
They're going to retire.
Okay, everybody, everybody got your hands up? Anyone? No? That's right. We're going to be seeing more of this. And, oh, guess what? That's already happened. Since then, I was trying to, like, wrap up
I'm
this
sorry,
story.
I ruined it for you.
news kept coming in. An even smaller village of 3,000 residents in Florida, Key Biscayne, was just yesterday hit. Officials reported, or I guess it was earlier because we have yet another one. Officials reported a ruck ransomware infection last week, but they haven't decided yet if they want to pay the ransom demand. A special session of the Village Council of Key Biscayne was held last Friday night with a second session on Saturday to determine how to respond to the ruck ransomware attack on the village's systems. No answer yet. What's happened is, as a consequence of this now sort of ongoing series of high-profile attacks, is that the public and the media are beginning to turn negative on city officials who fail to secure networks and then to decide to pay hackers.
Yeah, in fact, there's a term now, Riviera beached. You've been Riviera beached. So that'll give you some idea.
Yeah. So now paying ransom is viewed as a sign of a city administration's failure and weakness rather than being a quick fix to get access back for the citizens' data and so forth. And as we would expect, in following all of this up, forensics has always determined that it was a city employee who ushered the malware into the network by opening a malicious email and clicking on something.
But you can't blame the employee so much. Why is that malware getting through their intrusion detection systems? You know, why is it passing? You know, have they been trained? You can't completely blame the employee. This stuff's hard to spot.
Yes.
By the way, I want to there's an update on this from Ars Technica.
Okay.
According to Ars, Riviera Beach, in addition to the $600,000 they spent, will spend $1 million in remediation. So this is they're not done.
Wow.
And this morning, the Georgia Administrative Office of the Courts confirmed they've been hit by ruck.
Yes, and in the show notes.
Oh, is it in the notes?
And
okay.
Just as I was trying to wrap up the story, the state of Georgia's Judicial Council and Administrative Office of the Courts fell victim to a ruck ransomware attack.
So it makes sense because these smaller cities,
yes,
they don't have budget. They have valuable information. Plus, I thought about this. It's probably easier to spearfish them because they all have public websites. So does the Georgia court, where you can go and find the name of the city manager, his email. You can find the name of the comptroller, her email.
Right. Very good point.
So you don't have to do a lot of snooping around to get all everything you need.
And you could probably generate email, like, for example, spoof the sender data of some employee to be their boss because the managerial structure is also public knowledge. I mean, it's all public record. So you do some research and you generate very convincing looking email, which you then send to an unwitting employee and say, you know, hi, Betty, following up on our conversation recently, you know, here's the data that I told you I would provide.
You're the city manager and you send a note to the comptroller saying, this spreadsheet looks like the numbers are funny. Can you check it?
That's
all you have to say.
Yep.
And unfortunately, you still read news reports saying, watch out for email from people you don't know, which is exactly the wrong thing to watch out for. It's always from people you know.
So their infrastructure is publicly available. They are insured. So they've got, I mean, and one wonders how long insurance is going to be making these payments before either the rates start to skyrocket or the insurance companies say, hey, you know, we're not going to insure you against ransomware. You need to do training and you need to put systems in place and also, you know, seriously be able to back up and recover yourself from this kind of problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a – I mean, so there
– My guess, though, is this is not the insurance company in this case. What did you say? It was the Florida state governments? Florida
City government? Yeah, so maybe they called themselves
Association of Florida City Governments, something like that. It sounds like it's the governments themselves.
Florida League of Cities.
Yeah.
You're right. So it sounds like it's a private insurance pool that they all – that yes.
Nevertheless.
Yeah.
You don't really – how much is left? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. This is – of course. And you know what? If you're the Petaluma City Council or the Irvine City Council, your fiduciary duty means you get to go ask your IT director. What's the situation? Now, Steve, there's something I wanted to ask you about this. It seems like a simple backup would solve this problem. Is that not the case?
Yes, except that
it has to be offline because you can't have the virus infect it.
Correct. And the viruses also look for all connected drives and network drives. So if you could do a full nightly image of everything
and take it offline, take it offline or put it somewhere like a Glacier where it's immutable, or if you did that, and I think that's not so hard or expensive.
And I think the problem is it's just a matter of doing it. Like, for example, we still have Flash in browsers, like against all reason. Why? Well, because we've had it before. How long has it taken us to stop using old hashes and old ciphers? So the problem, I think, also is none of these municipalities have as much budget. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the IT people are saying to their
please buy us boards, a hard drive. Please,
yes,
I beg of you.
You know, like we need this much money in order, and I'm sure the city council says, we don't have it. I mean, we'd love to repave our roads, and we love to update our parking meters, and blah 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 blah. You know, I mean, so I'm sure it's just a matter of like the stuff is working.
Yeah.
And so
that's really what it is. By the way, user in our chat room just sent me a link to the Florida League of Cities Municipal Insurance Trust on the front page. Take our webinar on remediating and avoiding ransomware on the front page. And they're doing a webinar, but it's not till next week. So preventing ransomware tools, tips, techniques and technologies. Lots of T's in there.
It's like I'm, you know, so certainly preventing the infection is what you would like to do. That's the the least expensive thing you could do would be to somehow keep this from happening. But in a large organization, a large municipality, how do you get that message out to everyone, especially when they've got bad habits from home and from their phone and from everywhere else on the internet? And it only takes one. Yeah. That's the other problem is, you know, back when we were talking about Sony and the advanced persistent threat there, I said on the podcast, I don't want that job.
No,
you cannot secure something that big. You just can't.
On Saturday, we had in studio the man in charge of IT at West Point Military Academy. And I asked him about this because we were talking about this very story. And he said, well, we have the U.S. Army Cyber Defense Command on campus. And they're very good. He said, but the problem is you only have to make one mistake. You know, we have to be perfect. The hackers don't have to be perfect. We have to be perfect. No mistakes. And that's hard to do, no matter what, even for West Point. Even, you know.
And consider, in the case of the last two attacks, average of $500,000 ransom.
For that crying out loud. Buy a Synology. Put it in the closet.
That is a serious ransom.
Yeah.
Windfall for the bad guys. Mm. And how many cities are there in the United States?
Oh, yeah. And they're all bad, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Every one of them.
Well, because, again, it's aging infrastructure. It's systems that are, they're probably running, some of them are probably running XP still because they just, it's like, well, this works. Or our city infrastructure was written for XP and it won't run. It's 16-bit Windows code, and it won't run on Windows 7 or on Windows 10.
IT guy, run down to Costco right now, buy a 4-terabyte hard drive, USB. If you have to walk to every machine and copy the data off of that machine and then put that hard drive in the closet, do it now and do it every week from now on, right? At least. Seems like.
Yeah.
Criminy.
Well, and I've mentioned that because it is such a clear issue, and because ransomware will jump to and encrypt anything connected,
offline.
The system I have built dynamically mounts and images and then unmounts drives, which are not visible. Except during the brief window of time when I'm doing the imaging, because
you have to rotate the images in case the most current image copies the encrypted data. You have to one back. Yeah.
Exactly.
I don't think it's that hard. I think you got to do it. It's $88 for a 4-terabyte drive now. $88.
It's intent. I mean, it's like time. Like the IT guy is probably busy keeping his system up rather than then city council says, okay, you need to tell us that we're completely immune to a ransomware attack.
Nope.
And the IT guy says,
nope,
we're not. I've been telling you for 2 years, you know? And so, I mean, so maybe some money gets freed up, but again, as you said, it takes one mistake and it takes down a municipality that has insurance, deep pockets. They're going to pay the ransom because it's going to be far more expensive than they're basically gone until they limping along until they pay the ransom. And exactly as you said, in this case, the decryption keys were provided same day.
Yeah.
Here's your Bitcoin. Here's your decryption keys.
This guy's probably down the street, right? I mean, he's probably in the area. Maybe not, but it might as well be. But something else to mention is a good email system like Office 365, Microsoft Exchange, or Gmail will, in most cases, you're not going to get ruck through your email. You're just not. But what they can't filter out against is links, infected websites. I mean, they can, but they're not going to be up. You know, I can make today a website they wouldn't know about till tomorrow. So
there is an attack right now. I didn't get it into the show notes, but it's leveraging JavaScript obfuscated in images which are being served by ad servers to unwitting websites. And
how
so
do you avoid that, boy.
You also just don't click on an ad. Whoever clicked on an ad anyway? I don't know who clicks on ads. Only bots.
Well, couldn't
click
these
on
infect
ads,
you
think.
Without your clicking? I mean, they're just running code. Couldn't it just, if you had the flaw, you'd have to have a flaw in your browser, right? But remember that Firefox Zero Day.
That's right. You do not want to, because browsers are sandboxed, and so they're trying not to let anything out without some user action. And so there's a big difference between viewing something and clicking something. Clicking lets everything loose because you don't know what's behind that button.
Yep. Wow. It's a scary world.
Meanwhile, the going dark problem that we touch on from time to time is not going away. And I don't think it shows any signs of going away. A headline in Forbes caught my eye. The headline read, and just I'll say first that it's not true. It read, U.S. Well, okay, no. Technically, it is true.
It's not. Because it's a rumor.
Yes. U.S. may outlaw messaging encryption used by WhatsApp, iMessage, and others.
See, I've been watching this story with interest too, and I haven't talked about it on any of our shows because it's just a leak. It's a rumor.
Yeah. Right.
But the minute, and I wouldn't put it past President Trump, the minute that they propose this, we got to raise holy hell.
So, okay. So
but they haven't yet.
So Forbes saying that, normally pretty upstanding, although it wasn't an author who I know. There's a really
is
good.
Not upstanding. That's the problem. Is half their content's good, half their content's not.
Well, so this is U.S. may outlaw. Well, yeah, okay, may. Yeah,
yeah.
It may.
I might too.
So anyway, so I thought, what? How did I miss that? And so, of course, if the headline was more speculative than anything, anyway, I tracked down the source material for this article, which was a story in Politico, which actually had some useful reporting. The story was titled "Trump Officials Weigh Encryption Crackdown," and even that is a little inflammatory. But of course, clickbait. So, I've trimmed down what Politico wrote, removing a lot of the superfluous stuff and fluff, like of them explaining what encryption, end-to-end encryption is, that our audience, of course, all knows. But there were some interesting bits left which are useful for getting a sense of the environment. So paraphrasing heavily, senior Trump administration officials met last Wednesday to discuss whether to seek legislation prohibiting tech companies from using forms of encryption that law enforcement can't break. The encryption challenge, which the government, as we know, calls going dark, was the focus of a National Security Council, that's NSC, meeting Wednesday morning, last Wednesday, that included the number two officials, the so-called deputies, from several key agencies, according to three people who were familiar with the matter. So Politico says senior officials debated whether to ask Congress to effectively outlaw end-to-end encryption. One of the people interviewed said the two paths were to either put out a statement, a general position on encryption, and say that they would continue to work on a solution, or second path, to ask Congress for legislation. The unreported meeting of the NSC's so-called Deputies Committee did not produce a decision. A decision to press for legislation would have, this is Politico writing, far-reaching consequences for the privacy and security, effectively forcing companies such as Apple and Google to water down the security features on their smartphones and other devices. A ban on end-to-end encryption, which is not really what anyone is proposing, would make it easier for law enforcement and intelligence agents to access suspects' data. Yeah. But such a measure would also make it easier for hackers and spies to steal Americans' private data by creating loopholes in encryption, which is more correct, that are designed for the government but accessible to anyone who reverse engineers them. Okay, maybe. Watering down encryption would also endanger people who rely on scrambled communications to hide from stalkers and abusive ex-spouses, blah, blah, blah. Right. So, you know, this is just so Politico says Politico was unable to determine what participating agency leaders said during the meeting, but there is a well-known fault line on encryption within the executive branch. The DOJ and the FBI argue that catching criminals and terrorists should be the top priority, even if watering down encryption creates hacking risks. The Commerce and State Departments disagree, pointing to the economic, security, and diplomatic consequences of mandating encryption backdoors. DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is internally divided. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, the CISA we've talked about, knows the importance of encrypting sensitive data, especially in critical infrastructure operations. But ICE and the Secret Service regularly run into encryption roadblocks during their investigations. An NSC spokesperson declined to comment on the meeting. So the high-level NSC discussion highlights how policymakers have continued grappling with encryption even as it has receded from the headlines. And there's a lobbyist familiar with the discussions was quoted, "There is a significant administration-wide effort underway on what to do about the going dark issue." And then finally, they said tech companies such as Apple and Google, okay, that we all know about this, San Bernardino, we know about that. The transition between the Obama and Trump administrations saw a handoff of sorts between two high-profile advocates of the need to access encrypted data. After President Donald Trump fired Comey, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein or Stein, succeeded him as the government's top going dark warrior. Rosenstein, who dealt with the issue as a U.S. attorney, warned vaguely that cooperation with Silicon Valley was unlikely to work, implying that legislation might be needed. But now Rosenstein is gone, and experts generally agree that Congress is unlikely to pass a bill requiring warrant-compatible encryption. And that's the first time I've seen that term anywhere. So that, and that's interesting because that's sort of what we've been talking about. Warrant compatible encryption, meaning you still have encryption, but it's some means for under warrant allowing decryption, which the reason it's an interesting term is that we've talked about the Constitution's protections against unwarranted search and seizure that we have in the U.S., but under a warrant, that, you know, you're able to, if you're able to get a judge to issue a warrant, then law enforcement is able to do what they, you know, with probable cause to do what they feel they need to. And as we know, Senators Richard Burr and Dianne Feinstein floated a draft measure back in 2016 after the San Bernardino issue, but it was met with an intense backlash, which quickly killed any prospects for it going forward. So the presumption is that this was sort of a sentiment gauging meeting, which might be preliminary to more public and open talks. And in any event, as I followed up other links from this story, I discovered the Lawfare blog with its back and forth discussions about a proposal by the UK's GCHQ, which I referred to at the top of the show.
The Ghost Protocol.
Yes. The Ghost Protocol. We don't want to have time to talk about it this week, but I'm preliminarily titling next week's podcast The Ghost Protocol to discuss it at some length, because it's the first instance of a serious government-sourced quasi-compromise beyond where we are now, which is sort of an all or nothing. And there's been immediate pushback from the tech community. I mean, basically, the tech community is going to push back against any what they perceive as weakening of encryption. But there's no way around the fact that warrant-compatible encryption is a weakening of encryption. And so it's difficult to see how we move past this, but I think we're going to have to. I mean, either we decide that we need to get shims installed into the devices before the encryption, as we've talked about, so that we're not weakening the encryption. But the problem is, what law enforcement wants is everything to be recorded and then to be able to go back into previously recorded encrypted conversations and retrospectively decrypt them. And so the idea being, well, we don't, we don't know ahead of time what the conversations were for example, the case of the San Bernardino attack. They wanted to get the guy's smartphone and then look at what conversations had been had prior to the attack. So the fact that those are tantalizingly available is part of the problem. So I don't know. I mean, this is going to create a tension, and I think this is one of the most interesting things happening today in the security and privacy arena, is this problem, this tension between the fact that we now have math that cannot be cracked and governments are not happy with it. And Leo?
Take a break.
It's time.
It's time for everybody to get a quantum computer. If they don't like encryption, let them get a quantum computer. We wouldn't have to worry about it. Our show today, Brian, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about. Can you tell? Our show, we have been talking about the Ghost Protocol before, but this is a white paper, a proposal, and much like that, this National Security Council emergency meeting, it's something I think it's going to be hard to get through. I hope it's going to be hard to get through, but we shall see. Our show today brought to you by Cash. Cashfly, literally, if you download the show, you're using Cashfly. Cashfly is our CDN, our content delivery network. I don't have to tell you, probably, if you're a Security Now listener, what a CDN is. The idea is it distributes your content across to the edge, where it's closer to your user, your listener, if you're a podcast, your user, if you're an app or a website. Cashfly has servers all over the world, hundreds of them. And so, when people download the TWIT podcast, they go to the server that's nearest them. They get it much faster. I mean, much faster. CDN, Cashfly CDN delivers rich media content up to 10 times faster than traditional delivery methods, 30% faster even than other major CDNs. So if your website or your content is tied directly to company revenue, you want to give your customers not only the fastest downloads, but the most reliable downloads. One thing I love about being on Cashfly, we've been on Cashfly for 10 years. You remember, Steve, when we first started, I was begging people to seed our BitTorrent, and I was trying all sorts of ways to get this stuff out there, and it's just not easy. Matt Levine at Cashfly came to me and said, hey, we can help. And he has for more than 10 years now. And not once in that 10 years have I ever gotten a call, oh, the CDN's down, oh, We can't download your show. If you can't download our show, it's not their fault. It's never been their fault. It's always been our fault. We didn't put the show up, for instance. Cashfly is amazing. No 3 a.m. phone calls. They save us a ton of money, partly because our data, our downloads are spiky, like Security Now. A lot of downloads on Tuesday and less on Wednesday, Thursday. So our demand spikes up. Now, with a lot of content delivery networks, you got to be logging in all the time, make sure you haven't used your quota up. Not Cashfly. Cashfly does a great thing. They'll work with you to average your usage out over a year. So no matter what those spikes are, and we don't know when the spikes are going to happen or how big they're going to be, but we have a pretty good idea of what the yearly flow is going to be. So that way I save a lot of money. On average, you save about 20% on Cashfly. And because they have so many servers, 100% SLA. That's not 5 nines or 4 nines. That's 100%. That's all the way across. Cashfly guarantees the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are, no matter what device they're on. So many companies use Cashfly, not just Twit. Ars Technica uses it. Dan at 5x5 uses it. LG, Microsoft, Adobe uses it. It is the best way to deliver content. No billing spikes. You'll save 20%. You'll be 30% faster. And right now you could find out if you'd save, because if you go to securitynow.cashfly.com, they're going to offer you just, they'll take a look at your CDN bill and they'll tell you no hard pressure or anything. They'll tell you, here's what you can save. So don't be in mystery. Find out. Maybe you won't save anything. No big deal. But if you will, you'd be crazy not to switch, because they're the best. securitynow.cashfly.com. And thank you, Cashfly, for 10 years of great service and support. Support's good, too. Whenever I call a Cashfly engineer, usually because we screwed up, they are just great. securitynow.cashfly.com. Steve?
So our friends at Sophos Labs.
Yes.
Advanced the state of the art in Bluekeep exploits in a stunning proof of concept demo video, where, like, it's relatively short because there's no audio. It's all video. I don't think it makes sense for us to play it into the podcast, but I have a link to it, and in fact, I was going to, a little bit later in the podcast, introduce our listeners to a new service. Good. I'll play it while you talk,
and that way people watching can watch it, right?
Well, yes. It is amazing. What this demonstrates is they have two machines side by side in the same system. One is in a virtual machine, and they first demonstrate using remote desktop protocol to connect to this second machine, it requires a login. You get prompted for a username and password. You can't do anything else. Yet you're just stopped there. So then they close that session down, and then they launch their tool, which is their proof of concept, which they've created, which does some massaging of memory in order to prepare the exploit and the target machine. Once that's finished, they then close that, and basically that changes the target machine over RDP. They then relaunch an RDP session. And the other thing it does is when you bring up the remote desktop protocol desktop, down in the lower left is an accessibility button for those who need accessibility help. Their exploit changes what that is linked to bring up an admin system level console through remote desktop that gives you full access to the machine. So it's just a neat proof of concept. They are not making it public, but again, this is sort of a mixed blessing, because this also further demonstrates what can be done by people who know what they're doing. And we know that, unfortunately, there are probably as many people with mal agendas who know what they're doing as with good agendas. But I mentioned a link. I've been wanting to bring up a GRC-owned link shortener for some time. Our listeners all know that I've been a long-term user of Bitly, you know, the bit.ly. I've had .sc, I've had grc.sc as in shortcut for years. And the problem with using Bitly is that for some time, the pattern of the links I was generating were obvious. You know, it was bit.ly/sn-627 or something. And some rascals went ahead and pre-allocated a bunch of future Security Now episode numbers and related links just, you know, to be mischievous. And so I thought, okay, I need my own shortener. Anyway, so this is the debut of GRC's link shortener, grc.sc/bluekeep. And that will take anyone who's interested to this demo video, which is worth taking a look at if you didn't just see it in the video on the podcast, grc.sc/bluekeep. And it's a that just redirects to a link on Vimeo where the guys at Sophos Labs have put this. Still no evidence of a worm. And again, just to me, it doesn't make any sense. I think, you know, we've seen an XIM worm immediately appeared because the exploit was so time consuming. I imagine this is being exploited quietly, probably based on everything we're seeing. You know, we're seeing that what the bad guys want is money. They want Bitcoin. And so either you extort people by encrypting their networks in municipalities, or you put Bitcoin miners on people's servers that are apparently unattended and no one is paying any attention to, and you mine Bitcoin that way as part of a pool. So I would imagine a lot of these systems that have unupdated, we know that it's more than several million, have unupdated RDP servers. They're probably now increasingly running coin mining for someone. I had a tweet from someone about Squirrel. Joshua asked, he said, I have a question regarding a unique use case of Squirrel. I'm an active duty military and am frequently using controlled systems that don't allow installation of third-party software, including browser extensions. I also work either on underway ships or in areas where cell phones and other electronic devices are prohibited. Is there any way for Squirrel to work for me? He says, I tried to sign up for the forum, but my account is in moderation. And so, real quickly, if Squirrel succeeds, then part of I will consider success is that it becomes adopted by browsers. All we have to have is Chromium, the Chromium project, to decide, hey, this makes sense. Immediately then, well, and Mozilla too, and immediately Chrome and Edge get it, and then Mozilla follows, and we've got browsers covered. So the point being that eventually there's no way that this won't end up being built into browsers. It is a natural thing for that to happen. And I've said in GRC's news groups that you know, having finished a client for Windows, if I knew then what I know now, I would have done this as an extension. On the other hand, when I began this 6 years ago, we didn't have a common ecosystem for browser extensions. Everybody was disparate and nobody was synchronized, and the browsers were competing with each other to a much greater degree. So there wasn't a single solution. And there is something to be said for a single client running in a multi-browser system. That is, if you have the Windows client for Squirrel, then you can use it with Chrome and Firefox and IE. And so, you know, one installation of your client runs across all the browsers if it's in the OS. So maybe that'll be the other thing that'll happen, is it might be moved into the operating system. That's another place for it to be. So eventually, I mean, so in, I can get it where in a locked down environment, it's not possible to install things to make this work. And if you can't even put it in an outboard phone, then it's just going to, you're going to have to wait until it's, you know, because it does require some computation. I mean, at the same time, this environment wouldn't allow the use of a password manager. So I don't know what these people do. I guess they have a big book of passwords and somehow enter, hopefully, hard to memorize passwords manually, because if you can't install a password manager, how do you have a different password for every website?
I don't know if they go to websites, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And so in that case,
then they wouldn't need Squirrel. Right.
So why do you need Squirrel anyway? Right. And just so everyone knows, the Squirrel forums are moderated. We've got a big team of moderators who signed up in the beginning days, and I'm so grateful to them all, because essentially anybody who joins, just in order, because we don't want this to be a free for all and a spam fest and a mess, which, you know, unmoderated forums tend to devolve into. So people have to demonstrate that their intent is sincere. And if anyone starts to become a problem, we'll just remove them, because the point is for these forums to be useful for Squirrel users. They are not intended to be a place for, you know, people to spray their graffiti. So everybody is moderated when they start, and then they come off of moderation after they've proven themselves a little bit. And GMT also said, searched for Squirrel app on iTunes, found this. And then he said squirrel.chat. And I have no idea what that is. But the only way at the moment, because this has not yet been released to the iTunes store, Jeff is still working on it, is to join the forums, and you'll find links there to get on the beta team for the iOS, Squirrel for iOS, and then you're able to use it. And that's, you know, what I used as part of my Squirrel presentation.
In the chat room said that there is now a plugin for Squirrel for WordPress. Were you aware of that? Or
yes, there is.
That's great.
It's still in its early stages. That the guy who did the Squirrel for Android,
Daniel Persson,
he saw all of the conversation, and so he said he spent like between 8 and 10 hours. He knows PHP, and so he created it's not feature complete. I haven't looked at it closely, but it is working. And I've also heard that our good friend of the podcast, Rasmus Vind, who did the beautiful implementation of Squirrel for the forums, apparently another listener of ours has asked him to consider consulting to create a formal WordPress plugin. So that would be great. I would love to have Rasmus do a commercial grade version of a plugin for WordPress, which would be great. So yes, lots happening. There's work on native Squirrel for Linux. Several people are working on Mac OS versions. There's a lot going on.
Nice.
And Leo, I Am Mother.
I watched it.
Yes. And I think we talked about it at the end of the podcast. I don't remember if it was after we stopped recording, but you enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found I went looking for a review when someone posted in the most recent Security Now, Steve mentions a link he was going to send to Leo of a review of I Am Mother written by a guy who created an account on IMDb solely to post about the film. And this person says, did he ever share that URL during the podcast or in the show notes? I would love to read that review, but I haven't been able to spot it by idly browsing through all the reviews of that film on IMDb, nor by browsing or searching transcripts or skimming through the episodes. So when I went looking for that review in order to respond, I ran across another review that read, such an underrated piece of sci-fi. And I have a link to that review in the show notes. And he said, the reviews I read only gave me the impression that this would be a decent thriller, not .. He said, after watching one generic blockbuster after another, it's always so nice to see small creative films like I Am Mother are still getting made. I'm really curious about how much this film cost because it looks really impressive. But I also have the feeling that it was a very small budget. This film has solid acting and interesting characters. It touches on complicated ideas with a tightly paced narrative from start to finish and managed to keep me on the edge of my seat till the very end. If you love to treat yourself to some great science fiction, I highly recommend I Am Mother. And of course, our listeners know I recommend it too. Anyway, with the warning that this is a complete spoiler, and the reason you and I were talking about this particular review, that not the one I just read, the one I have a link to, but I cannot read, is that this guy who created an IMDb account just to post this, it's because he was annoyed by people not understanding the movie. I mean, you really do need to pay attention, especially at the end, where some things are said that are like, aha. I mean, it's sort of like that, where like the whole thing's been building and a few last pieces of a puzzle click into place. Anyway, this was going to be my first use of GRC's link shortener, and this is a good use for it. But again, warning, total spoiler. So for those who have seen it, or you know you will never see it, then grc.sc/IAM. grc.sc/IAM. You and I, Leo, both liked it.
Yeah, and I'm reading this, and now I realize I half understood what happened at the end.
Yeah, it was well conceived.
Yeah, very. But you'd have to do some math to really understand what it all meant.
Right.
I kind of suspected something, but now I understand completely. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but again, don't go there.
No. Watch it. Don't even watch the trailer. Just watch the movie.
Yes, the trailer, as I said originally, gave away way too much. Yeah. I mean, again, not the whole thing, but it's like, just better to see the movie. Yeah,
you'll enjoy it much more, I think.
And we've had a lot of tweets from our listeners who have said, thank you, thank you, thank you for the recommendation. I might have missed it if not for you guys talking about it. So it's been popular among our listeners.
Just to address that first review, which is, I wonder how much it cost. I think one of the reasons you see a lot of sci-fi taking place inside of spaceships, or in this case, inside of a facility, is that's cheap. That's really cheap. Because they build one set, they shoot the whole thing like Aliens, cheap. They shoot it in a set, and they don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to do anything. And I'm going to guess that there was a lot of CGI, a lot of computer graphics in there because there's... I can't say anything without giving away anything.
Yeah.
But there's enough detail that you would think, wow, this must have taken a lot of work. But so a lot of times when you make a movie, you can either do it with practical effects, physical things, or you do it with computer graphics. And of course, sometimes it's cheaper to do with practicals. But the kinds of graphics they had, I would suspect it was CGI.
Yeah,
and CGI set and two actors. Come on, cheap.
Yeah. And I think there was a lot of running down the same corridor over and over and over.
Yeah, you notice that corridor didn't change much.
Yeah.
You noticed that, did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's fine. So what? It was a great movie, a great story.
It worked.
Put the money.
Well, and again, isn't that what a movie is supposed to be?
Right.
We've sort of gone into this whole, like, you know, computer graphics overload, which is it's where it's more like a video game than it is a story with content.
Yeah, this doesn't, you know, this doesn't appear to be that at all.
No,
it's quite well done, I thought, and very provocative. The as with all great science fiction, the ideas are what make it interesting.
Yeah. I got a note from I guess it must have been email. Howdy, Steve and team. He says, "My name is Bob Johnson.
My name is Team.
Hello, team.
As team, I appreciate that.
I should have made it capital T.
Yeah.
He says, I've been using SpinRite since version 5. During that time, I was in the United States Air Force and was my fighter squadron's SCM. And he says, parens, small computer manager. He says, basically, I was the IT department. We had a copy of SpinRite version 5. He says, parens, I cannot vouch for its license, but we used it to recover many a crashed drive. He says, so when SpinRite 6 came out in 2004, I immediately bought one for myself. It was the best money I have ever spent, hands down. So now I'm fervently awaiting version 6.1. I have caught you from time to time mentioning your group of testers. I would like to be one of them. Am I correct in my understanding that only those that find their way to your forum/use feed/hideaway of testers get to beta test? Okay then, challenge accepted. When I have time to poke around, I'll find you guys. In the meantime, reserve me a copy of whatever the latest version is. Take care. See you around." He says, "Bob Johnson, avid SpinRite user, ketonian, and defeater of diabetes.
Oh.
The latter, thanks to you and your selfless research with your own N=1, meaning a sample size of 1, ketogenic experiment."
Nice.
So very, very cool. And just so for Bob and everybody else, I have two places now, for example, where there's squirrel discussion. There's the public web forums, and then there's our old school text only, boring, dry Usenet news groups. I am so much happier there. It's sort of with a good news reader, which I have, Gravity for Windows. I can mark threads unread. I can leave posts marked. It's sort of built in project management and dialogue and interaction and feedback in a community. That's where the work of SpinRite 6.1 will be happening. I don't have the same sense of presence or management ability in a web forum setting. It just isn't there. And it's not what it was meant for. So the way this will work is that I'll explain for people who are interested how to get into the news groups. The good news is most people won't want to. And frankly, we have a good set of people ready there already. But anybody with an existing SpinRite license will be able to use that to download whatever it is that is the current version under test, which I'm sure won't hurt anybody's hard drive. We never have, so I don't think that'll happen. But the point is, you don't have to participate in feedback in order to be able to play with what I've got. And it is my intention, as I have said, to be immediately producing useful code. So I'll be talking about it, obviously, on the podcast, since there's so much interest in that here. And that's how we'll manage that going forward. But not in the web forums. That just does not work for me. It'll be in the boring, dry, textual news groups because it's just – it's sort of a built-in project management environment. Someone calling himself Alan Turing, obviously not, tweeting as @CyberWarrior010, said, "Steve, not sure you have heard about this yet, so I thought I would drop it in your ear. I have found an XM worm that is, get this, patching the XM vulnerability. Fun stuff. I have screenshots if you're interested." I didn't follow up, but I just thought I would share the fact that, I mean, that's very cool. I mean, it's illegal to do any kind of a worm, but thank you, whoever you are, for breaking the law and patching people's email servers for them. That seems like a good thing, even though don't do that. James Alseth said, he said, quote, "There are no bugs," unquote. That's a hell of a claim. What test suites do you run? What are your testing processes? And I got a kick out of that. Of course, he's referring to my bold claim last week that SpinRite has no bugs because I did release 6 in 04, as Bob mentioned, 15 years ago, and I haven't touched it because there's nothing to fix. And I liked his question because it sort of reflects old school versus new school. My testing processes are 15 years worth of users using it and tech support standing by to tell me that I need anything to fix. And so it's actual use for 15 years on countless systems and hard drives that have never revealed that there's anything I can do except to advance it to its next version, which of course is my intention. And lastly, Spencer Daly, he said, "Hello again, Steve. This is a neat thing about uBlock Origin, probably worth mentioning. I remember back when you were deciding to switch from NoScript to uBlock Origin, and at the time, it was presented as a monolithic, do I run JavaScript or not dilemma. Since then, uBlock Origin has added the ability to disable JavaScript on a per-site basis," which of course is what NoScript used to have. He says, "It's the icon that looks like a script in the bottom right of the pop-up. It would probably be good, he writes, to let listeners know that they can selectively disable JavaScript on a site-by-site basis for a pretty big security and performance gain. Cheers, and a shout-out would be cool. Spencer Daly from Austin." So, Spencer, there's your shout-out and a thanks for making sure our listeners knew that just scripting can be enabled or disabled per site for anybody who is interested in doing that. It doesn't default normally, because again, we've sort of said, okay, you just can't run the internet, you know, today without scripting. And we're a little bit early, Leo, for our final sponsor insert, but I think we should. And yeah, then we're gonna dig into some news about exposed cloud databases and the redefinition of IoT.
We hear about them all the time. There seems to be more all the time. Our show today brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, you know, if you have sushi, that little ball of green stuff, wasabi, is hot, hot, hot. But when I'm talking about hot cloud storage, I don't mean quite the same thing. Actually, I'm going to recommend wasabi to any city government listening right now, because it is cloud storage, yes, very important for backup. But, and by the way, S3 compatible. So if you have an S3 program, it uses the same API as Amazon's S3. But it beats S3 in a few very important ways. First of all, there is no charge for API use or egress. That is a big upcharge that you don't maybe think about when you're using Amazon S3. But second of all, it has a very handy feature that I will highly recommend to city governments everywhere called immutability. You can designate this data may not be changed. Your backup can sit up there and viruses, malware, Trojans can be all over your system, but they cannot change that file. Nor can Jimmy in the mailroom or no other human error. That is exactly what you need if you need backup that is safe no matter what. Wasabi is an incredible company. Now, I know you probably don't know the name and you've heard of, you know about Amazon S3, you know about Google Cloud, you know about Microsoft Cloud. I just want you to add a fourth name because when the boss comes to you and says, hey, what cloud solution you recommend? It's okay if you say, well, boss, you can use the big guys, but there's this new guy in town that has some really nice features and costs you 80% less. Oh, and you'll like the fact that it's 6 times faster than S3. 80% less, 6 times faster, immutable storage, no charge for API, no charge for access, no charge for egress, 11 nines of durability. That means on average you'd lose one file every 659,000 years. That's pretty good. And absolutely key, you have complete access control mechanisms. You have bucket policies, ACLs that can be used to selectively grant permissions. And if that's not enough, just mark it immutable. It cannot be erased. It cannot be altered. Protected from hackers, from malware, from ransomware, and protected from yourself. You have active integrity checking. So every object on your Wasabi cloud is checked for integrity every 90 days. It's HIPAA compliant, FINRA compliant, CJIS compliant. So it's highly secure. It's disruptive. It comes from two guys I know well, David Friend, an old buddy, who was the CEO at Carbonite, his CTO, Jeff Flowers. They came up with a way at Carbonite of writing to disks sequentially rather than in blocks. And that they patented that. That was the key to Carbonite. They've moved on now to create Wasabi using that same technology. And that's why Wasabi is durable, fast, less expensive. It's really cool. Storage is radically affordable, fast, and secure. Wasabi, enterprise class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3. I want you to look at this. Calculate the savings for yourself. Actually, you can do it right now if you go to Wasabi, W-A-S-A-B-I, wasabi.com. Click the free trial link. Use security now. You'll get unlimited free storage for a month. That's plenty of time to really put a lot of stuff up there. And if you have a lot of stuff, by the way, ask about the Wasabi ball. You could transfer petabytes of data on this Wasabi ball. Send it right up there instantly. I love Wasabi. You will too. Wasabi.com, free trial link. Enter the code security now. Join the movement. Migrate your data to the cloud, but do it safely. Do it with confidence. I'm talking to you, Florida. Go to Wasabi.com. Make sure you use the offer code security now for that unlimited free storage for a month. Wasabi. Thank you, Wasabi, for your support. David Friend's done it again. Check it out. You owe it to yourself at wasabi.com. The offer code again, security now. Back to you, Steve Arino.
So, as we know, I've recently commented that I often don't bother to mention the more or less continuous flow of reports of publicly and inadvertently exposed cloud-based databases. They're not. These reports are not super interesting. I mean, it's like, yeah, millions of this and millions of that, but there's no real takeaway from each of those. If we had access to the internal details of each breach so that we could see and appreciate exactly how each of those happened, then that would make for some fascinating and probably teachable moments for the podcast. But normally, you know, there is no access to that. All we hear is, you know, somebody discovered this big database that was exposed. But one of the things we do know is that every one of these breaches must come down to two pivotal mistakes. First, probably without exception, the data that well, first of all, the data was never intended to be made public. Given what, you know, given the nature of the data which is disclosed, it's clearly not the intention of the people who are curating this data that it be publicly exposed. So that says that the database server should never have been bound to the public-facing server interface. So the developers of the database systems apparently wrongly assume that network-savvy engineers will be setting these systems up and will know better. So, you know, they'll bind the server to the local interface, not globally, you know, not 0.0.0.0, which is typically means, you know, all networks connected to an interface. Rather, they'll bind it to the internal LAN side so that it doesn't answer any calls from the public side. And then second, also without exception, we know that all access to the data, even internally, should be protected by some form of strong authentication mechanism, and preferably several forms. Only if both of these absolutely must-do measures have been ignored could we have the problems that we keep seeing occurring constantly out on the public internet. You know, the server is on a public-facing interface. It's bound to a public-facing interface, and there's no authentication. So it's given that being the case, it's really not accurate to call these data breaches, although the tech press often does, I guess because that sounds sexier. It's not a data breach when a web browser is used to access a website because a web server is publishing the website's contents. We don't call that a data breach. So neither is it a data breach when a database has been published by a database server onto the public internet so that anyone who queries the server will obtain the database's data. It might have been an inadvertent publication of that data, but no breaching of anything was required to obtain access. It was being openly served and publicly exposed. So this week, once again, several recent data exposures that, you know, and it was them all hitting, especially this third one, that I thought, okay, let's just stop for a minute and talk about this problem. So in the first of these three instances, we have more than 5 million records, 5 million, containing personal information and medical insurance data exposed in a database belonging to the insurance marketing website MedicareSupplement.com. MedicareSupplement.com is a U.S.-based marketing site which allows visitors to find supplemental medical insurance available in their area. Last Thursday, researchers said that they found this publicly available, this happened to be a MongoDB database, that had been online for several days and was unprotected by any password or other authentication. So again, like this 5 million plus record database of Medicare supplement insurance interested people. Bob Diachenko, who discovered the database along with researchers at Comparatech, told ThreatPost, who did some, a lot of people covered this, but ThreatPost said, or Bob said to ThreatPost, "While I have not seen any ransom notes or suspicious activity, the IP in question has first been indexed by a public search engine, Binary Edge, on May 10th. With a MongoDB exposed in the wild for such a long time," he said, "there is a very high likelihood that it has been accessed by others. Those 5 million records contained personal and personally identifiable data, including first and last names, physical addresses, IP addresses, email addresses, dates of birth, and gender. So if nothing else, here's 5 million records of strongly de-anonymizing data. And you can imagine, I mean, if we're in a world now where there are parties interested in exactly this, in de-anonymizing people for, you know, getting where is this email address physically located? What is the first and last name of the person with this email address? Their dates of birth and their gender. Well, here's 5 million instances out on the net waiting. Also, within that a subset, a 239,000 record subset of that more than 5 million also indicated the areas of interest for the customers, I guess, beyond just medical insurance, for example, specifically insurance for cancer, as well as life, auto, and supplemental insurance. So there was additional data. It sounds like it was a big marketing database, maybe that MedicareSupplement.com was using to say, hey, folks, come over and take a look at that our stuff. Anyway, the researchers disclosed the presence of this vulnerable database to MedicareSupplement.com, after which the database access was disabled and then proper security was put in place. So there's, again, this is an example of the stories that I'm constantly stumbling over and thinking, okay, this is only a 2-hour podcast. We don't have time to talk about like this constant problem with databases in the public. Second instance, also in the news this past week, were three and this generated a lot of headlines because Netflix, TD Bank, and another one I have in the show notes I'll get to, but some big names were in this, but this is huge. Okay, so three publicly accessible cloud storage AWS buckets, apparently under the control of an Israeli-based data management company, Attunity, Attunity, leaked, get this, more than, and we don't know how much more than, but more than a terabyte. Yes, that's more than 1,000 gigabytes of data belonging to half of the Fortune 100. That's, you know, the Fortune 100 are the, 100 largest companies in the U.S. So more than half a terabyte, I mean, more than a terabyte, and it's just that a terabyte was sampled, with half of the Fortune 100 and apparently about several thousand other less than the top 100 companies publicly leaked to the internet, including internal business documents, system passwords, and sensitive employee information. UpGuard was the group who discovered this open data, wrote up their discovery under the title Data Warehouse: How a Vendor for Half the Fortune 100 Exposed a Terabyte of Backups. They wrote, and I've paraphrased this a bit and cut out a bunch of the stuff that didn't make sense for the podcast. The UpGuard data breach research team, and again, not really a data breach when it's, you don't have to breach anything in order to get the data, can now disclose that a set of cloud storage buckets utilized by data management company Attunity have been secured from any future malicious action. Okay, we don't really know that. any current malicious action. Maybe they'll go open again. Who knows? Attunity recently acquired by business intelligence platform Qlik. And I guess that's how you'd say it. It's spelled Q-L-I-K. So probably they're trying to be, you know, Qlik. Q-L-I-K provides solutions for data integration. Yeah. An UpGuard researcher discovered three publicly accessible Amazon S3 buckets related to Attunity. And I'll just stop here because to editorialize for a minute about Amazon S3 buckets, you have to work to publicly expose them. I use Amazon. I use Amazon S3. And for example, I'm hosting videos, squirrel how-to videos on the squirrel forums through Amazon AWS. And it's work to make these things public. They're not public by default. So I'm always curious when I see, oh, yeah, there was an Amazon bucket exposed. Well, someone did that on purpose. You know, maybe they pushed the wrong button. I don't know. But I mean, you have to try. I just wanted to say that. It's not like it's happens by chance. Anyway, so they said, of those three, one contained a large collection of internal business documents. And oh my God, Leo, I thought I had the link in the show notes, and I don't, because you would be scrolling through it and your head would be spinning if you saw what was there. I mean, like, oh. Anyway, they said the total size is uncertain, but the researcher downloaded a sample of about a terabyte in size, including 750 gigabytes of compressed email backups. Think about that. 750 gig of compressed email. Email compresses down to nothing in size because it's typically text. So 750 gig of email, that's like everything from the beginning of, from the dawn of time. For like a huge number of people, 750 gig. They wrote backups of employees' OneDrive accounts were also present and spanned the wide range of information that employees need to perform their jobs. Email correspondence, system passwords, sales and marketing contact information, project specifications, and more. In other words, this was an archive of what we were just talking about, Leo, for being protected against ransomware. These were the encrypted, not encrypted. They were the backups of people's systems that were exposed in this Attunity bucket. On May 13th, 2019, they write, an UpGuard researcher discovered publicly accessible Amazon S3 buckets named Attunity-IT, Attunity-Patch, and Attunity-Support. The oldest files in Attunity-IT, where the bulk of the sensitive data was stored, were uploaded in September of 2014. So nearly 5 years ago, though that does not necessarily mean that they were publicly available at that time. The most recent files had been uploaded just days prior to the researcher discovering the bucket. So the bucket was in active use at the time of its discovery and contained at least 5 years of archived customer data, meaning it was the data was current and historical going 5 years back. The researcher, they write, notified Attunity on May 16th, 2019. As a result of time zone complications, they said, and due to Attunity having been recently acquired by Qlik, the researcher ultimately wound up speaking on the phone with Qlik support. By the next day, public access to the buckets had been removed. In previous cases, they wrote, we have discussed the complexity. I love this. We've discussed the complexity of fully analyzing and describing data stores that contain copies of users' workspaces and mailboxes. Work lives are spread across countless files, each one with some importance, but difficult to reduce to any single metric of significance. While various tools can help search across large data stores, gaining those quantitative measures comes at the expense of analyzing the qualitative nature of the data. In other words, there was too much data. You know, sorry, but 750 gigabytes, like, we didn't know what we had because there was too much to look at. They said there may be a large number of email addresses, for example, but whether they are enterprise customers or merely marketing targets changes the significance of their inclusion. A few key examples from the Attunity data set can illustrate the kinds of data that users have access to and which can be exposed by misconfigured storage of those users' file collections, as in this exposure of Attunity data. And then they said, according to Attunity's website, more than 2,000 enterprises and half the Fortune 100 use Attunity. And sure enough, a file with a client list found in the repository included a client list with a number of companies commensurate to that description. So they also found, apparently, Attunity's customer list. And, oh, look, there's the Fortune, there's half the Fortune 100 and a couple thousand others. They said every business must have customers, and having commercial relationships entails some exchange of information, leading many data exposures to involve third-party data for customers or other involved entities. In this case, Attunity's business in cloud migration and data integration also involves supplying and managing the software that processes customer data. Exhaustively documenting the files associated with each of thousands of companies is not feasible or necessary for the research team's purpose of raising awareness of the risks of data leaks. As in past reports, a few examples can highlight the kinds of information that can be exposed through misconfigured storage and were exposed in the case of Attunity. Their report then shows page after page of horrifyingly exposed data, even after having been heavily redacted for their own responsible disclosure. Things like password reset emails, mails saying, this is your VPN PIN and password, and much, much more. The idea of all of this data having been publicly exposed for who knows how long is sobering. This is the internal data of half the Fortune 100 and thousands of other large companies who were using this service, and it was inadvertently public. And of course, depending upon whose hands this fell into, and we don't know because it was there and UpGuard found it, and then after they reported it, it disappeared. But we don't know how long it was open. We don't know who and how many people sucked out these terabytes of internal company data, exposing thousands of companies, archived emails, OneDrive backups, and workstation contents. We just don't know. The tech press noted that among these companies were Netflix, TD Bank, and Ford.
Anyway, in conclusion, UpGuard's write-up said, as they're concluding, they said, Attunity's business is to replicate and migrate data into data lakes for centralized analytics. The risks to Attunity posed by exposed credentials, information, and communications, then, are risks to the security of the data they process. While many of the files are years old, the bucket was still in use at the time detected and reported by UpGuard, with the most recent files having been modified within days of discovery. The chain of events leading to the exposure of the data provides a useful lesson in the ecology of a data leak scenario. Users' workstations may be secured against attackers' break-in, but other IT processes can copy and expose the same data valued by attackers. When such backups are exposed, they contain a variety of data, from system credentials to personally identifiable information. Data is not safe if misconfigurations and process errors expose that data to the public internet. And I think that was a great point. The point here is that attackers needn't try to seduce their way into an enterprise's workstations to look around when their full backups are available for the taking due to the misconfiguration of an affiliated third-party cloud services provider. I mean, this was horrible, and we have no idea how long it was there before UpGuard found it and said, guys, you know, your back door is way open. Yikes. And we're not done yet.
There's more, but wait.
Yes, but wait. VPN Mentor reports Orvibo smart home devices leak billions of user records. They wrote, our expert cybersecurity research team, led by Noam Rotem and Ran Lokar, discovered an open database, once again, on the internet, open database linked to Orvibo smart home products. And Leo, go to Amazon and put in Orvibo smart home into the Amazon search. Orvibo. These are real people. The database,
despite the name.
Yes, despite the name, they're apparently well known. So this open database includes 2 billion logs that record everything from usernames, email addresses, and passwords to precise geolocations.
Oh, man.
As long as the database remains open, the amount of data available continues to increase each day. Orvibo claims to have around 1 million users. These include private individuals who connected their homes, as well as hotels and other businesses, with Orvibo smart home devices. This constitutes a massive breach of privacy with far-reaching implications, these guys write. The data breach affects users from around the world. They said, we found logs for users in China, Japan, Thailand, the US, the UK, Mexico, France, Australia, and Brazil. They wrote, we expect that there are more users represented in the 2 billion plus logs. We first contacted Orvibo via email on June 16th. When we did not receive a response after several days, we also tweeted the company to alert them to the breach. They still have not responded, nor has the breach been closed. So in this case, we have a company producing IoT devices, smart home devices, with more than 1 million active users and a log which is daily being posted to by these devices, numbering more than 2 billion records at this point. They said the amount of data available from Orvibo's servers is enormous. It's also highly specific, which shows just how much data smart home devices can collect about their users. According to the company, there are over a million users who have installed Orvibo products in their homes and businesses. The Chinese company, based in Shenzhen, manufactures 100 different smart home or smart automation products. Data included in the breach, and Leo, in the show notes, I have some redacted screenshots from the logs. Email addresses, passwords, account reset codes, precise location, IP address, username, user ID, family name, family ID, smart device, device that accessed the account, scheduling information. And so I have a picture that's been redacted showing this information. And without the redaction, there's the actual stuff. In this, and they say, in this first example, we can see that Orvibo is collecting a large amount of data about its users. In this case, not all of the data points are recorded. However, we have other examples that include very specific geo data, chosen family names, usernames, passwords, and the reset codes that would allow for account takeover. And they show another screenshot of that. And then a screenshot that follows. They say these data logs are for the same account, which we can verify with the matching email address and user ID number. In the first, we only had the email address, IP address, and a reset code. With this code accessible in the data, you could easily lock a user out of their account since you don't need access to their email to reset the password. The code is available for those who want to reset either their email address or password. This means a bad actor could permanently lock out a user from their account by changing first the password, then the email address. Orvibo does make some effort into concealing the passwords, which are hashed using MD5 without salt. The above example is a small sample. Okay, remember, more than 2 billion of these records. A small sample of the kind of geolocation data we have. Orvibo keeps logs of precise longitude and latitude coordinates, spelled LATOITIDE, in the data. The precision of the coordinates can lead us to a user's exact address. This also demonstrates that their products track location in their own right, rather than determining location based on an IP address. In this entry from a user in Mexico, it shows exactly which device the user was connected to when the data was logged. According to the Orvibo website, HomeMate is a full smart home system that employs a full range of their products to connect your entire home. This amount of data shows just how vulnerable a user can be should a hacker take advantage of this breach. Data which, again, is right now publicly available. One of the products Orvibo offers is a smart mirror. This includes technology to show the weather and display the user's schedule. Here, we have a log for the schedule the user has set with a customized name, winter week morning, giving us precise information about the user's calendar. This is a data log that includes a large number of devices connected to a single account. We can see a clear record of the user having one of Orvibo's smart cameras. Another device is named Massage Room, though not all the device names tell us which device is where. It could help someone to pinpoint a device to hack if they wanted to do so. The Massage Room label also points towards this data likely belonging to a business. Another smart camera log included a message that was recorded word for word. That opens the possibility of a user revealing even more personal information through their account. It's important to note that not every single data log included every type of personal information. However, even with over 2 billion records to search through, there was enough information to put together several threads and create a full picture of a user's identity. Okay, and now just for a minute, stop to consider that this is a Chinese company based in communist Shenzhen, China. The concern here is with a massive, incredibly irresponsible disclosure of extremely sensitive customer data. But even if this massive multi-billion record database were not exposed, it is still being gathered and retained. But to what end and business purpose? Why log all of this? A breach of this size, they say, has massive implications. Each device in Orvibo's product catalog can have a different negative impact on its users. This is on top of having an abundance of identifying information about users. Much of the data can be pieced together both to disrupt a person's home while possibly leading to further hacks. Though Orvibo does hash its passwords, we tested the security ourselves to see how easy it was to discover the real password. In some cases, we uncovered our own password. In order to test this, we created our own account, then searched for our email address to see what account information was accessible. Though our chosen password was hashed, it was easy to crack. If Orvibo, so they set up a device, an Orvibo device, created an account, set up a password, then they went and pulled the transactions from the publicly exposed transaction database on the internet, found it, found their hashed password, and reversed the simple MD5 hash in order to verify that that's what was going on. They said if Orvibo had added salt to their hashed passwords, it would have created a more complex string that is far more difficult to crack. Salt, blah, blah, blah. We know about salt, but these are unsalted MD5 passwords. They say there are Orvibo devices whose poor security could have secure consequences. A number of the devices offered by Orvibo fall under the umbrella of home security. They include smart locks, home security cameras, full smart home kits. With the information that has leaked, it's clear that there is nothing secure about these devices. Even having one of these devices installed could undermine rather than enhance your physical security. There's enough information leaked from the database that it makes taking over a user's account a simple task. A malicious actor could easily access the video feed from one of Orvibo's smart cameras by entering into another user's account with the credentials found in the database. At the same time, it would be easy to unlock a door from the same account. With precise geolocation, this simplifies home break-ins, and even an event smart homes are supposed to help protect against. And Leo, of course, this perfectly dovetails on what we were talking about last week, how utterly blind we are to everything having to do with today's IoT technology. This is a big deal. A huge number of people are installing interconnected, networked, essentially black boxes all over their homes, pressing a few buttons, and presto, look, I can check the dog while I'm away from home, see what the dog is doing. And of course, so can someone who may not have your best interests at heart. the industry has recently been talking about a worm, as we know, this notion of a blue keep worm with great concern. So much so that, as we've talked about it, Microsoft has issued multiple warnings. The U.S.'s NSA and DHS have done the same. But all of those 2+ billion Orvibo transaction log records were created by machine, so they could be read by machine and acted on instantaneously en masse by machine. So if someone in communist China wished, or somebody who grabbed that database off the public internet wished to, an attack could be launched against a million of Orvibo's customers instantly. It's horrifying. Anyway, so that brings us to my somewhat serious proposal for a renaming of what IoT stands for. I don't think it should be Internet of Things. I think IoT should stand for Installation of Trojan.
Yep.
And again, why are they logging billions of transaction records of their million plus customers? Why? What is the business purpose of keeping that kind of log? As an IoT vendor, we're trusting them. We press some buttons and, oh, look, all of our stuff is connected to the cloud, to something, or Vibo in Shenzhen. We have no control over anything that happens. And I mean, and that's important. We have no control. We don't know what is going on. Certainly, these million Orvibo users did not know that all of the information that they put into their apps and management, the schedule which they have given to their magic mirror that shows their schedule in the morning, is publicly accessible to anybody on the internet. It is really the Wild West, and what people are doing is installing Trojans into their homes.
And I wonder, you know, how much intentionality there is from Orvibo. Like, what are they up to, you know? It doesn't seem like it's an accident.
Well, the logging cannot be an accident. Yeah. Somewhere, I mean, they know they're providing storage space.
This. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Certainly it being public, one imagines, one has to imagine. But they're not even responding to email or tweets. Yeah. Like, they don't care.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And even if your stuff isn't from a Chinese company, it's often made in China. So, you know, who knows what's going on? We've seen.
Well, we have all of this whole Huawei thing going on right now. With you know, do we trust? I mean, as I've said, I'm surprised other countries are using Windows.
Right.
You know, that's just bizarre.
Right.
And and it does make sense after that scare we had of the Supermicro servers, where the question was raised. You know, is there some weird, hardware being embedded in the motherboards of these servers? You know, it looks like that was a bogus report, but it could happen.
Yeah. Okay, well, if it happens, you'll hear it here first. You can listen to us do this show live if you want. We do it Tuesdays at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. There's a audio and video stream always running of what we're doing live, or rebroadcast if we're not live, at twit.tv/live. You can choose your favorite stream there. If you are watching, you should probably be in the chat room or listening at irc.twit.tv with all the other folks watching and listening live. Steve has on-demand versions of the show, both audio and really nicely written transcripts. They take a few days to post after the show is over. Elaine's going to be typing this evening and working on that. You'll find those at grc.com. While you're there, check out SpinRite, the world's finest hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. Progress on Squirrel, the Squirrel forums are there. And there's lots of free stuff, useful stuff like a password generator that is second to none, all at grc.com, the Gibson Research Corporation. You'll find Steve on Twitter at SGGRC, and that's one of the ways to reach him. You can direct message him at SGGRC. You can also go to grc.com/feedback and fill out the feedback form there. He, I know, likes to hear from you. You can also get audio and video of this show from our site, twit.tv/SN for Security Now, twit.tv/SN. But as always, with all of our shows, we encourage you to subscribe. That's the best way to not only assure that you'll have a copy ready for your Wednesday morning commute, but that it helps us because we know you're going to download it. You won't skip it by accident. So subscribe in your favorite podcast application. Steve, thank you so much. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, buddy.
Security Now.